threatens.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
One of the biggest, baddest giant killers in the whole Bible was none other than Jesus himself. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert, our guest, the author of a long-running series, a best-selling series that fictionalizes the long-running war against the giants. And either he's brilliant in his research or he's jumped the shark here, and we'll find out over the course of the next hour. The latest book in the Chronicles of the Nephilim series, Book 8, is Jesus Triumphant, and it's our pleasure to welcome back to the bunker Brian Gadawa. Brian, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me on, Derek.
Jesus Triumphant, Book 8 in the Chronicles of the Nephilim. Intellectually, I know that Jesus is part of the triune Godhead, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and yet it never really dawned on me until looking at the book, like, oh yeah, he was right there when Moses and Noah and Joshua, you know, and Joshua went into the land of Canaan and had his wars against the giants.
It's funny. One of my fans, BDK, you know, who has Omega frequency, he's the one that sort of pointed that out to me and said, you know, and I said, you're right. And I looked into it and I ended up putting an article on my newsletter and stuff about it, that he said, you know, think about this. Do you think Jesus may have been a giant killer, literally? And I thought, my first response was like, oh no, have you jumped the shark? You know? But then he made the point that, well, look, if the angel of Yahweh in the Old Testament, there's a lot of strong scholarly, support that the angel of Yahweh was Jesus incarnate back then in a certain way, right? The second Yahweh in heaven, the visible Yahweh. And there's a lot of strong arguments for that. But if that's true, then you look at other passages where it talks about how the angel of Yahweh slaughtered the Assyrians. Mm-hmm. You know, what is it, 135,000 or something like that?
In a single night. Yeah,
in a single night, hundreds of thousands. And then also, like you mentioned, the scriptures talk about how the angel of Yahweh led before Joshua as he went into the land and killed these giants, etc. And, you know, I'm like, you know, you're right. If you really look into it and you face the reality, yeah, if the angel of Yahweh is Jesus, then Jesus was a giant killer. I know people are going to think that's crazy, but for those of us who really, you know, seek to try to understand and, you know, believe the Bible for what it says, not what we want it to say, sometimes we have to face changing our ideas. And that's what I actually had to do.
Hmm. So what was it? Was it this communication with BDK that led you down this path? Or was this something that just studying the research of Mike Heiser and the Divine Council Research Group that led to this conclusion that Jesus was not only a giant killer, but that there were giants that he had to contend with even right into his lifetime?
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, he sort of brought this point up while I can't remember if it was, I think it was while I was finishing up Jesus Triumphant. And of course, that point that he's making has to do with the Old Testament and going back in the past. Whether or not it has to do with Jesus in the New Testament is a different issue. But interestingly, I was struggling with that as well, because, you know, the whole premise of the series of Chronicles of the Nephilim is precisely that I'm retelling all the Bible stories where giants appear. And the reason why I'm doing that is because I think that there's a storyline that goes throughout the Old and the New Testament now, but I believe it goes through the Bible, and it's not just this arbitrary sort of like, oh, there's giants occasionally that show up here and there because they're weird anomalies or some obscure thing that we can't understand. There actually is a storyline, and that storyline I call the War of the Seed. And it, you know, it begins way back in Genesis 3:15, where God curses the serpent and he says, you know, I will put enmity between your seed and her seed, the seed of the serpent and the seed of Eve, and he shall crush your head and you shall bite his heel. And that's singular. So that's the first messianic scripture that sort of indicates what Messiah will ultimately do to the seed of the serpent. And so this goes throughout the text of scripture. And so I believe that the Nephilim are part of that seed of the serpent. Are they only that? Is the seed of the serpent only them? I think it's more than that. But nevertheless, they mark that seed of the serpent that then battles throughout the whole Old Testament. But I had always thought, but there's no giants in the gospel. So I'm thinking it's probably going to end when I first started researching, you know, years ago, it's like 4 years ago. I was thinking, it's probably going to end around David, because wasn't that the last of the giants? You know, David killed Goliath, but believe you me, when you read the text in 1 Samuel and Chronicles, there are more giants than Goliath. And in my novel, David Ascendant, I write about five other giants, including Lami, Goliath's brother, who actually were hunting down David. And this is implied in the text, in the Bible text. Now, of course, that's all it does is it names these giants and it names David's mighty men who killed them. But the indication is that they're after David. Mm-hmm. What is that about, right? And then, of course, David, as the first Messiah, because Messiah means anointed one, right? And he's the Messiah king of Israel at that time. He becomes the type of what the Christ or the Messiah would ultimately be, a son of David, right? So David, as this victorious king, is that type. And that's why when he, you know, destroys Goliath, it's much more than just this sort of, a model of you can conquer the giants in your life. You know, we like to use that as an example, but I think there's more to it than that. I think that it's a deeper type of how the Messiah conquers the serpent for us as Israelites stand and watch, as we, God's people, stand and watch Jesus defeats the serpent, right? But nevertheless, it talks about how David ended up wiping out the last of the Rephaim. Because when you read about the story of Joshua, you see Joshua coming into the land, and in Joshua 11, it talks about how he hunts down all the Anakim. And the Anakim are very explicitly in Numbers 13 described as being the descendants from the Nephilim. In other words, they're connected. And there are more giant clans that are talked about in Deuteronomy, the Emim, the Zuzim, and the Rephaim. And so the Rephaim are also part of these clans of giants. And so when David wipes the last of them out, or I'm sorry, when Joshua wipes them out from the land of Canaan, it says in Joshua 11, but he left some of them in the land of Philistia.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder why did he leave? Why did he go and finish wiping them out? And then you realize, it was when David, the king, Messiah king came, that he was the one who ultimately conquered the Philistines and wiped out the last of the Rephaim. And I think that God is trying to, you know, make that point. So I'm sitting there writing these novels that are telling these stories of Joshua and David and how they're fighting the giants and such. And I have a lot of romance in there too. So ladies, please trust, you know, I may not be the best romance guy, but I love romantic stories. And I have, you know, I think my story of Rahab in the Joshua Caleb books is probably, you know, could stand up against any other amazing romantic story you might read out there, but it's just not Amish. Sorry, it's not Amish.
that was one
no
of the
Amish
things
romance
that,
here.
That's one of the things that really surprised me when Sharon and I attended the Christian Bookseller Association's convention back in 2005 to release her novels, Winds of Evil and The Armageddon Strain. The authors that the booksellers lined up to meet, other than Chuck Norris and Sting, the wrestler, were the authors of the Christian bodice rippers. It was astounding to me, and not to say anything negative about it. They seemed like very nice ladies, but
there's a place for that.
Boy, that was the segment of Christian fiction that was really gone. And here we are over here with this, you know, this kind of science fiction type approach, and it was like, who are you? I didn't mean to derail the conversation there.
No problem, because I've actually been amused by that, but it's a reality.
It is amusing, yeah.
It is, you know, but that's what women love and such. So look, I'm a guy, and these Chronicles of Nephilim is definitely an action series, but I do try to weave in appropriate romances, and I try to actually show what good godly marriages are like, mm-hmm. including their sexuality, contrasted with evil, because I think in today's world, it seems like, you know, Christians don't want to talk about godly sex and the beauty of that union because it's, you know, it's inappropriate or whatever. And I disagree. I think we need to show marriage as being more desirable and even just as sensual and beautiful and all that stuff that they try to do with, you know, godless sex.
My wife and I joke that, you know, the kids these days, with the entertainment that they get from Hollywood, they just don't have a clue what it can be like. We've been married going on 18 years.
Congrats.
I'm trying to think of the date, make sure I got the date. 17 years, but it was actually 18 years ago that we first met. And we were early adopters. We met over the internet. Okay. Wouldn't recommend it for everyone, but it worked for us. But it is, as you're right, it's much deeper and sweeter than what the culture portrays to us. I mean, you know, we as guys, you know, I'm in my 50s now, and I'm supposed to, if I believe the commercials I keep seeing on TV, I'm supposed to want to drive a fast convertible and still act like I'm 20, you know, 19 years old. And I can with the help of a little blue pill, you know. But that's ridiculous. That's not the way God created us to be. Okay.
Yeah.
It's not supposed to be that way. So anyway.
Well, you'll like this because my one of the novels, Abraham Allegiance, is we're kind of going off on a tangent, but it's really not because, you know, I think that this is the kind of stuff that I put into my novels.
I would agree.
Because it's not being dealt with. And it's part of my life. And like you said, I've been married 28 years. And I'm madly in love with my wife.
Yep.
And there are changes that occur as you get older, but that's also, like you said, it's part of life and it's part of the beauty and intimacy. And our love is way deeper than it was when we were first married, even though when we were first married, we're a lot more active and everything is exciting and new. Mm-hmm. And that's what Hollywood tries to sell you is that newness, but they don't understand that actually, things can get stale over time, but they don't have to be if you work on them appropriately.
Exactly.
For example, Abraham Allegiant, right? Abraham lived to be, you know, how old, right? And they didn't have a kid till they were, well, I deal
90,
with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not yet, 90, right. So I deal with the fact that they're madly in love, he and Sarai at first, right? But mm-hmm. basically, you know, Abraham and Sarah, and I depict a marriage that is long-lasting and full of playful love that I've experienced. And I think that that's the kind of thing that we as Christians should do is elevate the good, not just show the bad, but I also don't think we should ignore the bad, which is why my Chronicles of Nephilim deals a lot with the sin of man. It deals a lot with violence, a lot with some sexuality, the depravity and what that means, because that way, when the redemption is shown against it, when the good love, good marriage is shown against the bad marriage or bad love or whatever, you know what I mean? It's shown to be that much better. It's shown to be more desirable. And at least that's my goal, you know, as I'm telling those stories. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's how it is on the romantic side, you know, we get into the life of David. Of course, he had multiple wives, right? So, you know, I talk about his first love with Michal, and then I go into Abigail, and I show some of that. And I tell the story before Bathsheba. Everyone thinks of Bathsheba, but actually my story takes place before Bathsheba. And so I deal with the realities that he had to, you know, before Bathsheba, there was Abigail and Michal, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. as well as Ahinoam, I think, was a third wife. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I get up to the time of David, right? You know, and I'm thinking, he pretty much finishes them off. So, you know, what's beyond
left?
That?
Yeah, what's left?
But then I started, as I studied the issue, and there's a couple different aspects to this, but one was, and yeah, Michael Heiser's work was what really launched me on this 5 years ago. His research is what opened my eyes and started me to really look into this. And I started to see that, no, actually the gospel ministry of Christ was the culmination of this war, but it's just not the way that we thought it might be. It's not by physically battling giants, although that was what it was in the Old Covenant. But what the Messiah would bring was not just atonement for sin through sacrifice and faith, yes, but he was actually culminating this war of the seed by achieving a final victory over the principalities and powers. And I know that Christians will recognize that concept because it's all over the New Testament. Paul talks about principalities and powers. Mm-hmm. And these principalities and powers are those sort of demonic spiritual authorities that are behind the nations. And this is a storyline also that's part of the Chronicles I'll get into that in a minute, but you know, basically the notion is I'll get into it right now. Deuteronomy 32, another principle that goes throughout the storyline of the War of the Seed is Deuteronomy 32 talks about how at the Tower of Babel, God separated the nations and the tongues, right? But then, and what were those nations? Well, Genesis 11 tells us there were 70, according to the way they saw it back then. So he separates the nations, and it says that he allotted those nations to the sons of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that you study that, you find out that these are the fallen gods, because they end up worshiping them, and it's false. They're false deities. But he says, but he allots Jacob or his people to himself, and then ultimately Canaan. So there's this principle that goes on in starts, you know, the Deuteronomy 32 worldview sort of sets this up by explaining that all the pagan nations, since they refuse to worship God, he gives them over under the authorities of these spiritual fallen beings. And the premise of Chronicles of the Nephilim is, I said, well, what if those, you know, we all know about the gods of the ancient world, they believed them, but we all assume they weren't real. But what if they were real beings and they were these fallen watchers, these fallen authorities? Well, if it's not literally true, it's certainly theologically true that I felt. And so that's what I started to tell the story. So I actually have these gods, whether it's the gods of Sumer, you know, Inanna, Anu, or as time goes on into Canaan, you've got Baal and Asherah. You've got all these deities, and they actually show up as real beings, because what Chronicles of Nephilim does is I'm showing the spiritual warfare. I'm showing what we don't see. And so I have some of these situations where guardian angels might battle the gods and such, and the gods are trying to manipulate the people through their religion and temples and all that kind of stuff, right? So I bring that dimension into it that people have really enjoyed. But it shows how those who are under the authority, the pagan nations are under the authority. And ancient world, all people believe this. They believe that behind a nation of Persia, say, there was a deity or their authority. And so if there was a battle on earth, there was a battle in the heavenlies. That's what they believed. And of course, Daniel 4 and 10 reaffirms this, doesn't it? With Prince of Persia, and that word Prince of Persia is not a physical prince, it's a supernatural prince, is fighting against the Prince of Israel, Michael, right? So this is a concept that goes throughout, and it doesn't end. I mean, it keeps going in the New Testament, my point here. So what Christ does is in his death, dissension, resurrection, and ascension, that whole package, he is achieving something that is hinted at in 1 Peter 3, where it talks about how he went down into Hades when he was dead when he was dead on the cross, his spirit went into Hades and proclaimed to the spirits in prison from Noah's day. Those were the ones that were the watchers who were bound at Noah's day, right? So there is something that's going on in the gospel, but even more than that. So in the novel, I try to show what is the spiritual reality. You've got the gods Baal and Asherah, who were the two key deities in Canaan. And there were many more, of course, but they were the key deities in Canaan that, if you read the Old Testament, the Israelites continued to fall away and worship those deities. So all throughout the series, I have all these gods and deities, and it all comes to a climax in Jesus Triumphant, where all of these guys are kind of, they realize Messiah's here, and they want to try to stop him. So you've got guardian angels come and battling them and such. And this is going on in the background, but I also deal with what's going on with Jesus and his disciples. But I just want to make the point that I'm dealing with this battle of the authorities, because when Christ dies and descends into hell or Hades, he actually does something down there, and he mm-hmm. achieves this victory, you know. And
we're told that in the Apostles' Creed, that on the third day he, you know, rose again, or he was crucified on the cross, died, was buried, descended into hell, and then on the third day rose again. So that,
exactly,
part of the very early creeds of the church.
Absolutely. But by the way, that word hell, I think, is a misnomer, and that's something I actually explain in Jesus Triumphant, because when we say hell, we think of there's a fiery pit that when you go to when you die, but that's actually not what the ancients meant when they used hell. They actually, the equivalent would be Hades. And what Hades was is the same as Sheol in the Old Testament. And Hades is the abode of the dead. And what was that like? You know, the only notion, you know, the Old Testament doesn't really say much about that. It just talks about darkness and dreariness and all this kind of stuff. But we get most of our ideas from either the Greek notion of Hades or, you know, Dante or Milton, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I said, you know what? I'm going to tell the story of Christ going down into Hades, and which, of course, is really challenging, right? But I thought, I want to do a uniquely Hebrew vision. I don't want to follow the Greek vision, right? You know, makes sense. But I thought, where could I find some description of that? Well, about the best place to find a halfway decent description of what Hades might look like is in the vision of Enoch in the Book of Enoch. And so Enoch is a book, the first Enoch primarily, but this was a book that was respected by the church throughout all of history. Mm-hmm. And only in recent years have they rejected it. And I think because we have more of a materialistic sort of faith, you know, we don't like to describe those scary things, the spirit, supernatural things. But also, I think what really convinced me to use it as a source was the Bible itself, the Book of Jude. And the Book of 1 Peter and 2 Peter, they both quote and allude to. And by the way, that's not the only ones. There are allusions to the Book of Enoch in other texts. So I wrote a whole article on this. You can get it free on my website. So the idea is that so Jude actually quotes Enoch and talks about how, you know, God says he will come with 10,000 of his holy ones to execute judgment on the earth, etc. He's quoting literally from that text. Mm-hmm. But some people try to say, yeah, but just quoting one sentence doesn't mean he accepts the whole thing. Sure, granted. But the problem is the whole book of Jude is referencing ideas and concepts from the book of 1 Enoch, the watchers who were imprisoned, right? Mm-hmm. And their fleshly, you know, going after strange flesh. This is all stuff from the book of Enoch. And so my goal was, well, you know, if it's good enough for the apostle Jude and Peter, it's good enough for me. And even though I don't consider the book of Enoch to be scripture, I give it a high regard, and I used it as a source to tell my story. So you'll read this Jesus's descent into hell, into Hades, and you're going to see kind of, and I even put a little map in there about how Enoch sort of perceived Hades. And I had to fill in some gaps because it's not all consistent and such. But, you know, so that was a fun time. I think people will really find that really fascinating and interesting. But, you know, we're talking more about these fantastic things, and some of these things are in Jesus triumphant, but there's another side to the story. And that other side has to do with, let me put it this way. When I thought, how am I going to tell a story of Jesus? You know, we know it so well. And Christians are going to be really picky, you know, if I
start tinkering with the storyline. Yeah.
Yeah. If I'm meddling with the Gospels. Well, I try to stay as true as I can and fill in between the lines where things that we don't know about and be consistent with what we do know. And also sometimes even illuminate something that's in the Gospels that doesn't make sense to our modern eyes. Case in point, this is how it all ties into the Nephilim. Yes, there are no giants in the Gospels, but I believe that there are Nephilim in the Gospels. And here's what I mean by that. Whenever I read the Gospels, and you know, you'd see Jesus casting out demons and stuff like that, and I would always go, well, what's the point? Is he just showing I'm powerful and I have power over the spirit world? No, the Bible's much richer than just that, making that little shallow point, right? And even his healings, you know, it's not just I have power to heal, I'm powerful. No. He's actually engaging in a theological conclusion to this war of the seed. And what I mean by that is this. We don't, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, you don't hear anything about evil spirits, maybe once or twice. And there is some references to the demonic nature of the gods, but there's no demon possession. We don't read about it except it with Saul, right? Saul is tormented by an evil spirit. But there's really almost nothing at all. And then all of a sudden, Messiah comes. And there's
demons
people
everywhere.
Being demons everywhere. Yeah. You know, it's almost like a Frank Peretti novel. My gosh, you know, and
hell's a popping. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and Legion and all this stuff. And I'm like, what? Why is that? Well, I think here's what's going on. I go back to the book of Enoch and in the Bible, it doesn't say what evil spirits are or where they come from. It just says they're there. And a lot of Christians assume, oh, they're fallen angels, right? Like, because Satan, fallen angel. Mm-hmm. Well, no, actually, if you look at the notion of angel in the Old Testament, particularly, because that's where it kind of starts, you find that angels are actually physical beings. And when I say that, they have a heavenly flesh. It's a flesh that can, of course, go between dimensions. I don't deny that. But it talks about them eating food with Abraham, having sexual intercourse with human women in Genesis 6. So these are physical beings. And even though they have transfigurational bodies, maybe, they're bodies. They're not just spirits who are floating around. But evil spirits are actually looking for hosts, physical hosts. So they're two different things. And the fall, if you're going to use the word fallen angels, that best fits the notion of the watchers or the sons of God. Again, they're not just spirits, they're actual beings. So the Book of Enoch actually does make some claims, and it claims that the evil spirits or demons are the spirits of the dead Nephilim. Now, if you're a biblical Christian, at first blush, you'll kind of go, oh, come on, really? I mean, there's nothing like that in the Bible. So, yeah, I'm saying I'm not sure, but I think it makes better sense theologically, and it certainly is consistent with the Bible, and here's why. Because if the Nephilim really are hybrids of angel and human, mm-hmm. then when they die, they're different than when a human dies. When a human dies, the Old Testament says he goes to Sheol or Hades, and there they wait for the last judgment. Both good and evil go to Sheol, and so they're waiting the last judgment. But the Nephilim are actually hybrids of angels that wouldn't necessarily go to Hades, right? So. Right. It makes sense that they might be the spirits that continue to the Satan is prince of the power of the air, right? So demons are in the air, so to speak. So the Book of Enoch says that. And now that makes sense to me, because what is Jesus as Messiah doing? He's making the final battle by casting out the Nephilim from the land of Israel to purify it for his kingdom. And it would make sense, because the Israelites had worshipped these false gods, Baal and Asherah, right, for so long. It was embedded within their culture. We find a lot of this. You know, there were hundreds of years where they would worship Baal and Asherah, right? So I think that Jesus is the final, like, sort of like overthrowing of the Nephilim by casting these demons out. And then by healing the unclean, he makes the unclean clean. And this is the point of what Messiah does, is he's coming and he's bringing the kingdom of God. He's inaugurating it. It's inaugurated, but not fully consummated. And he's cleansing the land and purifying the people for the reign of Messiah. And then, you know, Paul says that he reigns from the right hand of God now, even though we don't see everyone under his authority, they are. So it's sort of a legal. So my point here that I'm getting to is Jesus Triumphant tells this notion of how Jesus accomplishes the legal establishment, inauguration of God's kingdom, of taking away the authority of these gods of the nations. It's sort of like a goes to court, God's mm-hmm. heavenly court, right? Which is his divine counsel. Mm-hmm. And he takes away their deeds of the land, so to speak. And then that's why he breaks the barrier between Jew and Gentile. And that's why now Gentiles from every tribe and every nation now can have faith, because they were all blinded by mm-hmm. the gods of this world. But now that's been taken away. Jesus came and bound Satan when he, in his ministry on earth, from being able to deceive the nations. And so—
And symbolically, he even makes that point when he sends out the 70 to go around Galilee and preach the gospel. It was sort of a cosmic in-your-face to the 70 who were put over the nations after the Tower of Babel incident.
Excellent point, you know, and that's where, and then in the Book of Acts, which I actually do finish, I kind of jump forward a little bit at the end of my book, and because the Book of Acts makes the point that when all these people are speaking in the various languages, these languages are those languages of those nations from Genesis 11 that were under the authority of the gods.
Yes.
And so— he's undoing Babel is the point. So my whole series, I have Babel way back in Abraham Allegiant, and mm-hmm. it's all connected. And Jesus Triumphant is sort of like concluding a lot of these storylines. Of course, we're not done yet. There's still more to talk about that. But, there's the whole Caesarea Philippi thing. But so that's some of the storyline. But I also have, I wanted to retell the gospel. I wanted to interact with the gospel in a new and fresh way. And of course, people have done it through the eyes of Peter and even through the eyes of Judas, you know, and that's cool, you know, but I wanted to do it through the eyes of someone you would never have thought of. So what I do is my main characters in the story, I decided I wanted to tell it through the eyes of the two thieves on the cross.
Ah.
And I'm going to give a little bit of a spoiler here because I don't think it'll ruin it. The Bible talks about these thieves on the cross. And when we think that, we think, oh yeah, kleptomaniacs, they stole something. No, the word for thief is actually lestai. And you don't get crucified for stealing a sheep. Hmm. But the word Lestai, Josephus, the ancient Jewish historian, tells us is the word that he used to describe the revolutionaries in the time of Christ, the ones who were rising up and trying to overthrow Rome's power.
Okay, and he knew and, a little something about that because he was a general in the revolt against Rome.
Exactly. Yeah. Who'd you say?
Josephus.
Josephus, exactly, exactly. Yeah. So those thieves were actually revolutionaries. They were action characters. And so not only that, but also we all know the story of Barabbas, right? Barabbas was the guy who, when Pilate said, hey, I'll release one prisoner to show my godly kindness, you know, my godlike kindness, right? Mercy, godlike mercy. He says, who will you want released? And they said, Barabbas, Barabbas. Well, it says, I think it's in Luke where it says, Barabbas was in jail because he led a failed insurrection in Jerusalem. I'm like, whoa. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of these insurrections going on at the time, like terrorists, basically, right? And so Barabbas, too, was like one of these warriors. So I said, what if these thieves actually were somehow connected to Barabbas? And so I tell the story of two brothers, Gestas and Damaris, and one of them is a bestiarius. And a bestiarius is a guy who fights wild beasts in the arena rather than gladiators, right?
It was a little more politically correct back in the day than it is now.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, yeah. Exactly. They would go and catch exotic animals like tigers and bears, and they would fight them to the death. And then his brother is an actor who plays Hercules in the theater. So he also can fight, but he's more of a ladies' man, right? And so these two brothers, whose lives have been destroyed by Rome and under the oppression, they get unwittingly pulled into this revolutionary movement. They actually don't want to start that way, but it pulls them in, and they meet Barabbas. And here's what happens is Barabbas finds out that there's this guy, this Galilean walk going around saying he's Messiah. They call him the Nazarene. I want you guys to go and find out who he is. See if he's on our side. Maybe we can team up. Or if he's not, if he thinks he's going to be the big cheese, then kill him.
Yeah.
And so my guys go to find out about Christ. And then that's how they see through those eyes. So it's kind of a, you know, I've got some action figures and characters in there. And I also bring in Mary Magdalene. And I have a take on Mary Magdalene that will blow your mind because it makes more sense, I think, of what the scripture says. The tradition is that she was a prostitute, but the Bible doesn't say that.
No. And it says that Jesus cast out seven demons, right?
Seven demons. Yeah. And I thought, well, okay, technically that could be possible of anybody, but I think it'd be more consistent with making her into something different. So I make Mary Magdalene a different kind of a character that will be more conducive to this notion of why does she have seven demons in her, right? So I'm dealing with all these sort of weird things in the Bible that we are afraid to face, including the one, the one verse in Matthew where it says that, you know, when Jesus died, there's an earthquake and some Old Testament saints rose from the dead and went to Jerusalem.
Right, right. And people saw him walking around, which is an interesting claim because Matthew writes it and says, you know, hey, by the way, you know, people saw them walking around, which was, you know, in a way was at the time the Gospel of Matthew was being circulated, was a way of saying, if you don't believe me, go to Jerusalem and ask around. Because there were witnesses to what had happened. Interesting. That was one of the inspirations for David W. Lowe's book, Earthquake Resurrection.
Oh, I haven't read that yet. Interesting. I like David. He's a great guy. Yes, we have good little debates with each other.
Yeah, and I'm trouncing his team this week in Heiser's Fantasy Baseball League. So, yeah.
By the way, his book, I recommend it.
Deconstructing Lucifer.
Deconstructing Lucifer. You know, it's kind of controversial, but I loved it. I loved it, and I agree with a lot of what he said. But so I try to deal with these obscure passages. And there's another one that's really wild. Oh, so anyway, so I make sense of those resurrected saints in context of this whole storyline of the War of the Seed. I believe it's consistent with scripture, you know. But there's another element. It's always been weird to me that why Jesus said his ministry was to come to the lost sheep of Israel. Well, then why did he go out of his way up to Tyre and Sidon near the end, and then Caesarea Philippi, because Tyre and Sidon are part of Phoenicia, and they're not part of, you know, Canaan or whatever, ultimately they wanted to conquer all of that. But, Tyre and Sidon happen to be the strongholds of the gods Asherah and Baal. Baal, Asherah was the goddess of the Sidonians, and Baal was a key figure at Tyre. And so you can see where this is going. I think Jesus was going out of his way to sort of do some kind of spiritual battle there. And what, we don't know, but I fill that in my story and give it a fantastic kind of edge to it that people love.
And that makes perfect sense. As we talked about previously, one of the things that really has astonished me about the story of the Exodus, which we're all familiar with the story. Yeah, Moses comes back and he, you know, begs Pharaoh to let them go, and he won't. And they, you know, got, Yahweh sends the plagues, and they finally send the people out. And, you know, final miracle, cross the Red Sea. God parts the sea, they cross, and the Egyptian army is destroyed. What I had missed for my entire life until about 2 months ago was this: the last command before God says, okay, now hold up your arms and I'll part the sea, is turn around. He tells the Egyptian, the Israelites to turn around and go back so they can cross at a place opposite Baal Zephon, is what Scripture tells us. Baal Zephon is a site that was holy to Baal.
Wow.
Along the Red Sea. So, it, you know, there at the beginning of the Exodus, Moses is told by God, you know, this is where you're going to cross. And Baal, not only being the storm god, was also the god of maritime navigation. So wow. On top of that, God's, you know, Yahweh is not only demonstrating right in front of a site holy to the God of the North, Baal. He was doing it on his home turf, as it were. You know, you're supposed to be the God of the sea. Watch this. Seas part, Israelites cross, Egyptians killed, all die. So this trip to Sidon and Tyre, to Caesarea Philippi, makes perfect sense. It's bookending the whole story. It's amazing.
And like, as you said, as you've told me, it's like the battle of the cosmic mountains, you know. Who was it who you said wrote on that?
Oh, yeah, I meant to send you that link. Chris Putnam.
Chris Putnam, right.
Chris Putnam.
Well, I believe, too, that there is a battle of cosmic mountains. And what that means is, as you've already said, that, for example, you know, Mount Sinai versus Baal Zephon and stuff. Well, I think it continues on even into the New Testament. And here's where we get a climactic moment. Actually, in some ways, the climax of my story is, you know, Christ goes to Caesarea Philippi, and that's where he says, you know, Peter, upon this rock I will build my church, you know. And of course, you know, Catholics and Protestants debate, is it building upon Peter, or is it building upon the confession of the Christ? And I actually think it's not really either so much as it is something else. He is standing at in the foothills of Mount Hermon.
Ah, where the
Mount Hermon's a big rock.
Yep.
And here's what's interesting. All the way back to the very beginning, and this is some of this comes out of the book of Enoch, but it's also in the Old Testament as well. Mount Hermon was the location that the fallen watchers came down and first started way back in Genesis. Yeah. And ever since that time, it had been the symbol of the cosmic mountain of the gods, and the location, basically the location, the central location of sort of the headquarters of evil to Israel, because it's right there in the land of Bashan, and the land and the tribe of Dan actually ended up there, and they completely fell away from God. And it was, you know, the land of Bashan actually means place of the serpent. And so even Dan worshiped all these false gods and stuff. So by the time Jesus gets there, Caesarea Philippi is just, you know, it's totally paganized, and it's at the foothill of Mount Hermon. And when he says the gates of hell shall not prevail, he's not— We all know the adage that, you know, gates are a defensive weapon. So, you know, he's being offensive. But it's more than that. That location was there was a cave, a grotto of Pan, where Pan was worshipped. And Judd Burton actually makes a really good argument that it goes back to Azazel, actually. Mm-hmm. So he's at this grotto that was called the Gates of Hades.
Yeah.
So when he's saying gates of Hades won't prevail, he's saying this rock, this gates of, where the gates of Hades leads into, and the mountain was behind it, right? It's not going to stand. And what's interesting is he's not just making this declaration, because right after that is the transfiguration. And where is the transfiguration? On Mount Hermon.
Right.
And what is a transfiguration, right? I mean, is it just, I am glorious? No, I think there's more to it than that. And what exactly, I'm not sure, but I think there's a lot of connection to, we get back to the divine council. And the divine council were the heavenly sons of God surrounding God's throne, that myriads upon myriads, right? And the Bible describes them as shining ones. And even Satan himself is a shining one who's fallen, right? And so the shining ones— glowing. Why? Because I think it has something to do with them being perpetually in the presence of God. Because what happened when Moses was in the presence of God? Mm-hmm. He started to glow, but his glow would fade because he was still human, and it was a temporary thing. But Jesus, so I think what's going on there is Jesus is going to Mount Hermon, and he's declaring that he is the Son of God. you know, the very God in the flesh.
Right.
And that transfiguration is his expression of deity, right? And it's also his call to war against those shining ones who came down on Mount Hermon, which he would then ultimately defeat when he died and went down to Hades, right? So what I'm saying is this, all this stuff comes out in Jesus Triumphant in a very cool action-oriented way. And I have guardian angels battling demons and gods and Jesus casting out demons and such. And I even have a revolutionary movement at the time, people rising up and saying, I'm Messiah. No, I'm Messiah, right?
Like Life of Brian.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you know, they're trying to make fun of
yes, a very belief. Real historic period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, that's sort of I think that's a big picture of everything that's going on in the series of the Chronicles, as well as how I start to wrap it up with Jesus Triumphant. Mm-hmm. And it's not the last book in the series, though. There is another one after it, because the temple and the city were destroyed around 70 AD, and there was still some stuff that I believe was yet to be finished. And so I do have one novel coming, but this novel is sort of like the climax, and the next novel will be the denouement, maybe? I don't know. Full of a lot of war and battle, but and romance. Women, mm-hmm. romance. So the Jesus Triumphant sort of marks that climactic conclusion of everything that goes throughout the Chronicles. So if you're a fan of the series, it's going to be a lot of things are going to be wrapped up in many ways, but with a few loose ends that need to be fixed. But if you haven't read the series, I did try to write it in a way that it might be standalone enough mm-hmm. that you could appreciate it. And you will, you won't be confused, but you certainly won't get the full impact of those of us who have followed these watchers, mm-hmm. you know, these bad guys throughout all of history as they've battled and tried to take over, and the chosen line of God from Noah to Abraham to Joshua, Rahab, and all that, all the way up to Christ. We're following these characters and how they're interacting and stuff. But you still, you know, it technically could be read, but you'll probably read and go, oh, I should read the whole series, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, you so did an admirable. Well, you did an admirable job of bringing in all that plot exposition without making it boring in the early scene, the early conference, the introductory scene or the prologue, if you will, at the end of the 40 days in the wilderness. There are other authors who have done similar things, and it's like, okay, it just, you know, you're giving me the plot summary of the previous books, and it's reading like a plot summary of the previous books, and it's not very interesting.
You got to appreciate, though, how hard it is to do, Derek, because,
yeah.
you know, we're trying to find that balance between the people who already know everything, but then, you want to get new readers and all that. Let me put it this way.
Sure.
Yeah, I have greater appreciation because I had to do it, you know. I appreciate that you like that. And the way I did that, actually, just to give people a taste, is I start the novel with Jesus' fasting in the wilderness, the 40 days and 40 nights, where he's confronting Satan. And his interactions with Satan are what I bring out all the stuff from the past. So it's kind of if you want to bring out exposition, one of the best ways to do it in novels as well as movies, which is my background, you put it in the context of either action or thrills or horror, you know. So of course you've got this confrontation between the ultimate bad guy and Christ. And by the way, in the novel, I call the Satan, I call him Belial, because that's mm-hmm. also a name that's used of him in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. And Belial was a fascinating name to me because it sort of represents the ultimate wickedness. And so he goes by Belial. He goes by many names throughout the Bible, as well as other Jewish literature, whether it's Mastema, Samael, Hillel ben Shakar, the Satan. Mm-hmm. You know, people think that Satan is his proper name, but actually that's a Hebrew it's a transliteration of the original Hebrew Hasatanos, which actually means adversary or accuser.
Yeah.
So it's
more
really
like a job title.
Yeah, it's a job title. You know, and in fact, there are some scholars that even suggest that there may not have been a specific individual in the Old Testament.
Could have been, like prosecuting attorney or district attorney, you know, somebody who gets elected every, you know, so often.
Now, of course, in Revelation, though, I think the New Testament does sort of link the serpent to the Satan. And so I'm okay with that. But mm-hmm. I'm just saying that it's fascinating to see it through different eyes, and you sort of see an angle you're not used to seeing when you realize, no, the point of it was he, you know, in the Old Testament, the Satan is not like the ultimate evil bad guy. He is the accuser, but like you said, he's part of this heavenly court, the divine council. He's the prosecutor that accuses, and then God justifies or condemns. And that's where the prophets come in. The prophets, too, were like lawyers. They bring lawsuits against Israel for their disobedience to God, see? And so this legal covenantal is what I call it, a legal covenantal thing, is what God's divine council is all about. It's a legal throne room. And that, and in fact, like I think Jeremiah or Isaiah talks about how the proof of a prophet is one who has stood in the divine council, actually presenting a case. How that occurs, I don't know, but that's what sort of gives the, what would you call it, the affirmation of a true prophet, right? Mm-hmm. Not just that he said what he says comes true, but he also, he stands in God's divine council and engages, you know? So it's a fascinating supernatural worldview that I'm trying to bring out that, quite frankly, I got to admit, it's not my background. You know, I come from a more conservative, reformed background, but by studying the Bible, I had to kind of face that there's more of a supernatural thing going on here than I like to admit. And I believe the Bible, so I've got to really embrace this. And that's what this whole series has sort of been a way for me to sort of embrace it and try to tell a story that would also fascinate people, because it's more than just, see, there are demons. See, there is spiritual warfare. It's like, well, here's what it all means. Because yeah. I don't, you know.
It's a lot deeper and richer. The palette for an author writing based on scripture is a lot, it has a lot more on it than most authors are aware. The ongoing spiritual war is a lot more complex. In fact, one of the things that you allude to, which I thought was interesting, in the initial confrontation between Belial and Jesus, is that Belial allows us how he's now in charge of all of the kingdoms of the earth. When we know that at the time of the Tower of Babel, God numbered the nations, divided the nations according to the number of the sons of God, the number of watchers who eventually rebelled, allowed themselves to be worshipped. So we see in the book of Daniel that there was a prince of Persia who was the supernatural entity over Persia. There was a prince of Greece. And now Belial is in charge of them all. So that implies that there's some political maneuvering and maybe some backstabbing, some deal making that goes on behind the scenes. I mean, maybe something like what you got in Chicago prior to an election. I don't know. I'm from Chicago. You're from the Chicago area. Maybe Me that too. Informs our theology to some degree. But there's something more to it. They're not all operating in the same, they're not all pulling in the same direction. They've got their own selfish aims, goals, and desires that they're trying to fulfill
for power.
Right. And that is alluded to. And again, that to me is fascinating because it makes sense based on what we read in the scripture. It makes some of the things that were hard to understand fall into place.
Yeah, you know, that you make a good point there, because that had been a problem for me, because I'm like, okay, well, if it talks about all these gods of the nations and all these territories, and there are like you said, princes of Persia, and well, why in the time of the New Testament, it's sort of like they're not there anymore, and only the Satan is talked about, like he's the god of this world.
Right.
Several times it says that, the prince of the power there. There's that word prince again, principalities and powers. It's like, what happened to all the other guys? You know, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading Walter Wink, actually, and he talks about how in the intertestamental period, there was more writings and suggestions that what occurred was maybe, and this is speculation, but it makes sense of the text, and that is maybe Belial or the Satan was the principality of Rome. And think about it.
Yes.
If all these beings, like if behind a national power, there's a spiritual supernatural power. Well, if one of those powers takes over the world, well, then wouldn't the supernatural power behind them sort of be the chief god of the world, right?
And that's you would
what
think
happened
so.
With Rome.
And that's how Jesus refers to Satan, the prince of this world, the god of this world.
Yes, yes. So it's not just that he was the only one. It was that he was the most powerful at that time. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it makes sense of all the other, because the Bible continues to talk about principalities and powers. So yeah, that made sense to me. And so I bring that out in Jesus Triumphant in a way that I think will make some sense and people will really appreciate.
One final question here, in order to keep this to a manageable, because I know me and I know you, and we could spend the rest of the afternoon talking. But one of the details that I was not aware of, and that's one of the things I appreciate about your work, is that I always find something that I didn't know before. Not that I'm the smartest guy in the room, but I like to think I am. And that is the presence of an actual giant, not just the disembodied spirits of the Nephilim in the form of demons, but there's a giant who appears in Jesus triumphant. Where did he come from? Because we don't read about him in the Bible.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I wasn't going to have any giants because there weren't any in the Gospels. And right. I thought, you know, I don't want to jump the shark, you know, and throw some giants in there unless there was some historical documentation for it. And in the course of my research, I stumbled upon a giant. Sure enough, in Josephus's writings, he writes about a specific giant, and it's not, I mean, it's actually a little mini story. His name is Eliezer, and he's actually Jewish, but he's 10 and a half feet tall.
Wow.
And it talks about how he was a gift from the Parthians who were battling Rome, and they were making a treaty at the time, and it says he was a gift from Parthia to Rome, and he was going to be taken to Antioch in order to be brought to Rome, right? But that's all it says. And then it says Herod Antipas actually went up and was wormed his way into the negotiations. And who's Herod Antipas? Well, he happens to be the guy who cut off John the Baptist's head. He's involved in trying to find out who Jesus is, right? So that's very interesting to me. And anyway, so Josephus talks about this. And then I was looking in the footnotes and stuff, and they were saying, you know, that this happened roughly around 33, 34 AD, which is like right around that time period of Christ.
Yes.
And maybe the last years, you know. Of course, any date they give, you're never really sure. So it could be anywhere from 5 to 10 years difference, right?
Right.
So he was right there at that time. And then I looked at where it occurred, and he was traded in the Euphrates and brought across to Antioch. And basically, he was traveling about 50, 60 miles north of Caesarea Philippi, which was the gates of Hades. So I thought, okay, what if he escaped? What if he found out that he's one of the seed of the serpent, and he finds out this Messiah guy's around, and he goes down to, and escapes and tries to kill Messiah and confronts him?
Yeah.
What would that be like? So I tell a story that I think people will like. And like I said, I didn't make it up out of whole cloth. You know, there's actually was one at that time period, you know, and it's a little fun, a little speculative. But also I think what occurs through that is also gives me an opportunity to sort of express as well. You know, I've got this whole series where they're, you know, you've got people fighting these Nephilim giants. Well, how would Jesus confront them? You know, because he came to die. He didn't come to fight. So how would he overcome? And how he deals with that giant, I think, is an expression of the gospel. Yeah. But you'll have to just, you know, read that to find out how I deal with it. But it's really funny.
Awesome.
Not funny. It's cool.
Jesus Triumphant is Chronicles of the Nephilim, Book 8. There is one more forthcoming. Brian Goodell, of course, the author. Brian, where do people find out more and get themselves a copy of Jesus Triumphant or the previous 7 in the series?
They're all exclusively on Amazon right now. Actually, there will be some other versions out elsewhere, but they're on Amazon, so you can go to the buy them and you can buy them in Kindle, paperback, or Audible. I do audio versions, and people are loving the audio version.
Oh, sure.
And yeah, and then if you want to get more information before you buy it, go to the website chroniclesofthenephilim.com, and there's tons of free stuff there, book trailers, author videos, artwork, free articles, explanations, everything. You'll really love it and enjoy it. I tried to really give it some value to make it worth going there. But also, I just want to alert you know, your listeners and stuff that if the series is rated PG-13, because like I said, you know, I do deal with evil and sexual violence and some language to really describe the reality. It's very, I mean, it's not horrible, but it is, you know, about PG-13. So for people who are more sensitive to that kind of stuff, who might be offended by the description of evil, I've done a whole nother version of the series where I edited out that more gritty stuff, shall we say. Still the same exciting novel series, but it's called Chronicles of the Nephilim for Young Adults. And every title is just, instead of Jesus Triumphant, it's Jesus Triumphant for Young Adults. Or no, I'm sorry, Young Adult Edition.
Mm-hmm.
So just look for Chronicles of the Nephilim Young Adult Edition if you're a more sensitive person and can't handle the sort of grittiness of evil.
Yeah.
It'll still capture everything really well. You'll appreciate it.
And the title of your book, because you've also published a nonfiction book that kind of lays out the theological case for the existence of the giants back in the day? Was it when giants walked the earth?
When giants were upon the earth.
Upon the earth, okay.
And that what happened was every book I put an appendix in because I wanted to provide the biblical and ancient historical research for those people, Christians like myself, who might go, this stuff is so wild. Did you make it all up? Well, mm-hmm. No, I really didn't. I drew it from different ancient sources. And I knew people would appreciate that and want to have that. So I put those appendixes in each book. Well, I got so many fans saying, look, I love the appendix as much as the rest of the book. So I thought, well, for those who wanted to just do the Bible study material and the ancient history, I took all those appendixes out, put them in a single book, and it flows like you wouldn't believe, like a river. So and that's where when giants were upon the earth, and for those of you who want to just go straight to the Bible study or have it all in one place, it's a great little volume.
All right. Brian Godow is the author of the Chronicles of the Nephilim series, The Chronicles of the Watchers forthcoming. When will those start to appear?
Yes. I started a series with Charlie Wen, and Charlie was the visual director at Marvel Studios, and we wanted to tell the story of the first emperor of China, and we realized that there's a connection to this watcher paradigm, and so we tell a little bit of a slightly fantastic story, but we tell the true historical story, but we embellish it with the supernatural reality. Mm-hmm. And that might be not out for another 3 or 4 months, but that's coming up, and people will really love that because cool. it goes outside of the Bible, but it's very very connected, and you'll love it.
Very cool. Well, if we don't talk again,
yes, it's called The Dragon King. Yeah, there'll be a web page up soon on my website for The Dragon King for those who want to find out, but it's still not going to be released for a few months.
Well, if we don't talk before, then we'll definitely talk when that's available. Brian, thanks very much for your time today. Sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
ChroniclesOfTheNephilim.com is the website to find out what's going on in that series. And, of course, there'll be a link in the show notes at vftb.net as well. This week, we'll also, like I did with the interview with Tim Mahoney regarding the movie Patterns of Evidence, I will post a video version of this interview. Learned very quickly to try to kill two birds with one stone. It's kind of helpful if I can. And by getting some video of Brian, I'm also adding some potential content to the daily updates that I record for Skywatch TV. So, and it gives me an opportunity to plug some of his work on Skywatch TV. And hopefully, before too long, you'll get a chance to see him sit down in front of the cameras there. May not happen before the end of this year, but at least at some point, we hope we can make that happen. But we'll work on that and see if we can bring that to fruition. But in the meanwhile, you get a chance to see him face to face. Look for the link to the video version of the interview if you're curious at vftb.net. Just a couple of quick items in the news so as not to drag the program out too terribly long. But again, surprise, surprise, the life in space meme continues. We see reports this week that astronomers have spotted Stonehenge-style standing stones on Comet 67P. This is the one that the European Space Agency's Philae lander, the Rosetta program, has been examining. They claim that there are some standing stones there that look like Stonehenge on the surface of the comet. And, of course, the question then is, who would be there to put standing stones in a sort of a monument on the surface of a comet? Well, of course, we're not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens. Alien hunters also finding more aliens. And of course, just if you're a new listener to View from the Bunker, that is tongue in cheek. Okay. The reason for bringing up these stories of UFOs and the UFO meme is because that is what the media, and, you know, I don't know if there's any actual coordinated conspiracy to put these stories out. I seriously doubt it. But I do believe that because all of us, whether we realize it or not, are influenced by the unseen realm. In other words, you're on the battlefield, whether you recognize it or not, may be influenced by without even their knowledge. And in part because it sells. People are curious about the big questions. Where did we come from? Why are we here? Where do we go when we die? And some believe they may find the answers in a UFO, that God may pilot a spaceship. So as much as we can laugh about the ridiculous backstory behind Scientology, I mean, setting aside the fact that it brutally oppresses anyone in or out of the organization who dares question LRH, setting that aside and just, you know, looking at their actual backstory, you know, the evil alien Xenu, and all of that, there are a lot of people who are willing to give stuff almost as ridiculous credence. I will say again, National Geographic's survey in, was it 2012? As it was getting ready to launch another alien chaser, UFO chaser story, if their research is correct, and I don't have any reason to believe that it's not, about four times as many American adults believe that we're being visited by extraterrestrials than believe in the God of the Bible. And that information based on the research of George Barna and the Barna Group. So, but we keep seeing these stories appearing in relatively respectable mainstream news outlets. So there are groups out there, people out there who are poring over every digital image sent back by the Curiosity rover on Mars. And within the last couple of weeks, we've been told that they found a stone that is hovering about a meter off the ground, a pyramid that is of artificial origin, a crab or crab-like creature hugging the side of a rock, and now a veiled woman. And this is in addition to other things that have been found there, like the sneaker, the lizard, and the dinosaur fossil on Mars. All of those things within the last few weeks. The thing that really made me laugh was when I was looking at a story at Inquisitor.com, and I recognize the Inquisitor is not the Telegraph or CNN or any Fox News, but even there, I mean, they just went so far out of their way to try to tie a legitimate archaeological discovery to the potential of life in space, that it was comical. The Inquisitor was reporting on a find by Israeli archaeologists off the coast of Sicily of a stone monument that they're calling the Underwater Stonehenge. It's under 150 feet of water. Speculation, it could relate to the myth of Atlantis. And then they tied that to the story of the Stonehenge in space on Comet 67P. Again, that's what we're supposed to believe. Life began out there, was seeded here, and we're just the product of an asteroid collision into an ocean, seeding organic chemicals into the seas, which then, over time and with many accidents, became you and me. Yeah. Anyway, coming up on A View from the Bunker, we've got, I think, some interesting interviews just ahead. Josh Tolley was in the Ozarks here to visit the bunker in the Ozarks for Skywatch TV. And he talked about his book, Evangelpreneur, which is about the biblical support for the entrepreneurial mindset and how being entrepreneurial is actually good stewardship. So while he was in studio for the television interview, I grabbed him, dragged him back into my sound room, and we managed to talk for about half an hour. Talked a little bit about that. Also talked about the lie of the population explosion. Says really there's a population implosion coming. And it's got some very profound impacts economically and geopolitically. So we talked about that. You'll hear that on Wednesday night, August 12th, on the 16th. An interview I've been looking forward to for quite some time. Mark Flynn, author of the fascinating book Forbidden Secrets of the Labyrinth. And hopefully we'll get Perelandra Kilns, who has been the curator of the work of Mark's twin brother, David Flynn, whom we lost too soon to a fatal brain tumor couple of years ago. If you've been a longtime listener, you will remember interviews that we did with David about his fascinating work on the occult signature of the 1947 Roswell crash, Daniel 3:3, and the relationship of Washington, D.C. to Babylon, and other discussions throughout the years. Mark, his brother, has put together a book that builds on that work, Forbidden Secrets of the Labyrinth, and we'll talk with him. You'll hear that a week from tonight, August 16th, Sunday, August 16th, here on VFTB.net. And then Mark Combs returns, author of End the Beginning, about the flood of Noah and why it occurred. We'll talk about, catastrophism, I guess. We're tentatively titling the episode, and this is not original to me, so forgive me, fellas at the Fourth Watch, for stealing your title, but it's a good one. From Noah to Planet X. That interview will be posted on Wednesday, August 19th. Mark Combs and a discussion of what might be coming and whether or not we should be concerned. Okay. We've really hit an interesting section of the Old Testament in our weekly Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship. We went through Numbers chapters 21 through 24 this week, and that's posted online at gilberthouse.org. And that those three chapters encompass the episode of the bronze serpent on the pole, okay, the fiery serpents that God sent to punish the people of Israel for complaining again. And you look at the English language, you think fiery serpents, okay, serpents with a really painful venomous sting or something. Until you look at the Hebrew and you realize that the words translated as fiery serpents are seraph nakash, the root word of seraphim, one of the classes of angel, and nakash, which was the name given to the being that tempted Eve and Adam to partake of the forbidden fruit in Genesis chapter 3. So you've got something more going on here than just poisonous snakes, venomous snakes afflicting the people of Israel. And then Moses, who's commanded by God to make a representation of it, put it on a pole so that when people get bit, they could look at it and live. What was going on with that? Plus the victories over the Amorite kings, the giants, Sihon and Og, and then the prophecies of Balaam. This is some really fascinating stuff that we went through today. We, you know, again, in the span of an hour, you can only dig down so far, but even at that, I think we covered some really interesting stuff. So if you've not been listening, encourage you to do that. Subscribe to the podcast and get them fed automatically to you. We upload those every Sunday morning. The Gilbert House Fellowship, a chronological study of the Bible. We just go through it in the order in which the, in the order of the events as they occurred, which means we occasionally skip around a little bit. Like there'll be some Psalms that'll be dropped into the middle of the book of Numbers here because those Psalms are attributed to Moses. So that is a Sunday morning. Again, generally posted by mid, late morning on Sundays at gilberthouse.org. And this Tuesday night, second part of the two-part interview with Chris Putnam on Skywatch TV that airs on the Christian Television Network Tuesday night at 8:30 p.m. Central Time. If you get satellite TV, either Dish or DirecTV, that's Dish Network 267, DirecTV Channel 376, the Christian Television Network, that is, Glory Star Satellite, Channel 117 also. And if you don't have satellite TV, you can watch it, you'd watch the internet stream. The Christian Television Network streams its programming live to the web at ctnonline.com. And of course, if that's not an option either, we've also got the Roku option. If you've got a Roku device, you can add the Skywatch TV Roku channel to your account and watch those programs on demand. And, of course, there's always the YouTube channel. So plenty of ways to catch it, but we will get that program up there. Chris's book, The Supernatural Worldview, I think one of the most important for apologetics in recent years because it establishes the existence of the Bible and makes the point that as the scientific realm is growing closer toward accepting the existence of the supernatural realm, we in the church are basically demythologizing, trying to desupernaturalize the Bible and turn it into just life coaching. To paraphrase the Apostle Paul, if we are living our best life now, we are most miserable of all men. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.